What I'd like to do this afternoon is to describe several sorts of archaeological discoveries which have revolutionized our understanding of Tanakh and our understanding of the Talmud. The first half of the presentation will focus primarily on Tanakh. The second half will focus on Talmud and rabbinic literature. Before we proceed, it's essential that we discuss briefly the nature of archaeology and what we mean by archaeological discovery. So what I mean by it is, in the first instance, the scientific study of the material remains of any given culture. Such remains usually recovered by means of systematic excavation. I say in the first instance, for archaeology is much more broadly defined. It also treats matters of the spirit. Written documents are often discovered by archaeologists, and their content is often far more significant than either the ink or the paper or papyrus they happen to be written on. In other words, one cannot separate matter from spirit. So, for example, in ancient Egypt, as you well know, tombs have been discovered and excavated. And very often, baskets of fruit are discovered, flasks of wine, and other foods or remains of foods are found next to the deceased. An unimaginative archaeologist would probably report that certain wines and foods were available in antiquity and so on and so forth. But an alert archaeologist, however, would suggest, at the very least, that the ancient Egyptians believed that the dead consumed food on their way or on their journey to the underworld, or perhaps it was necessary to have food left with them because there would be an afterlife where that food would become necessary. So the alert archaeologist does not merely report the dry facts, he tries to interpret them in a meaningful way. And when he does so, he leaves the realm of the material and enters the realm of historical interpretation. Or if you like, he moves from the descriptive to the speculative. I shall begin with two levels of archaeological discovery with regard to Tanakh, moving from the simple to the complex. The first level will deal with archaeological discoveries that enlighten our understanding of biblical Hebrew. And the second level will deal with discoveries that enlighten our understanding of biblical law and Jewish thought. The 24 books of the Hebrew Bible were reduced to writing somewhere between 1400 and 300 or 200 BCE, when Hebrew was a vibrant language, and certainly in the biblical period, the primary language spoken by Jews in the Promised Land. But by about 400 BC, Aramaic began replacing Hebrew because it became the lingua franca of the Near East, much like English is the language of much of scholarship throughout the world today. Hebrew lost the vigor of its youth and was eventually superseded in the Jewish world and in many other circles in the Near East by Aramaic. Not to be revived again, that is Hebrew as a spoken language, until modern times. In the interim, the precise meaning of a variety of Hebrew words that occur in Tanakh were forgotten. During the past 100 years, however, archaeologists have made discoveries throughout Eretz Yisrael. They've discovered hundreds of inscriptions in Hebrew and in related Semitic languages outside of Israel, such as Ugaritic, Phoenician, and Akkadian, all these languages from the biblical period. Many biblical words whose meanings would otherwise have eluded us also appear in these inscriptions, and due to their new context that we have, the lost meanings of the Hebrew words have been recovered. Please take a look at passage one, and we'll look at our first sample. So you should all have it in front of you. 1 Samuel 13 provides the background of the famous battle at Michmash. Michmash was a town just north of Jerusalem. Here, a major battle would be fought between King Saul, the first Israelite king, and Israel's traditional enemy, the Philistines. Militarily speaking, the odds were heavily in favor of the Philistines, who outnumbered the Israelites and who were equipped with more sophisticated weaponry. To prove the point, the narrator in 1 Samuel 13 informs us, and you can either follow the Hebrew or the English at verse 19, no smith was to be found in the land of Israel. Of course, by smith, we mean a metal worker, somebody who fashions and repairs metals. For the Philistines were afraid that the Hebrews would make swords or spears. So it's clear that the Philistines were in control, so much in control that no Israelite was able to sharpen their agricultural tools. They had to bring them down to a Philistine city in order to get them sharpened. Verse 20, so all the Israelites had to go down to the Philistines to have their plowshares, their mattocks, their axes and coulters sharpened and so on. Then comes verse 21. The difficult words are v'haita hapsira pim, and a series of tools follows that. And we pick up again in verse 22, thus on the day of the battle, no sword or spear was to be found in the possession of any of the troops with Saul and Jonathan. Just for those of you who haven't learned all of Tanakh yet, despite all this, the Israelites won that particular battle. They defeated the Philistines. But that's not our concern right now. Our concern is the first part of verse 21. What does this mean? Until recently, it really was not understood. It presents a series of words whose meanings couldn't be fathomed. Especially enigmatic was the third word, the verse, pim, which appears nowhere else in all of Tanakh. Any such word is called a hapax legomenon. It means a word that occurs only once in Tanakh, and almost by definition, a word that occurs only once in Tanakh is a word that we really don't know what it means. What we know is that the previous verse is talking about farmers' tools, and this verse, too, lists a whole series of tools. And so the medieval Jewish commentators, and as a matter of fact, the medieval Christian commentators as well, all the commentators, said, we'll do the best we can with the verse, and it must be that Psira Pim is the name of a tool. And it actually, it must be referring to a file that was used to sharpen tools. So Vaita Psira Pim Lamachare Shot, etc. There was a tool available, a file with which plain sense would be the Philistines, but Rashi says the Israelites were able to actually sharpen tools at home. As I say, this was a guess, even in terms of Rashi, for those who may know, Rashi doesn't give a source. There is no Talmudic source. Nowhere in the Talmud is the word Pim ever explained. So where did Rashi get this from? We don't have time to get into the fine details. But Rashi had a Talmid Chaver, a wonderful Jew by the name of Rabbi Yosef Kara. And Rabbi Yosef Kara writes that Rashi got this from Rabbi Nachem Rabbi Chelbo. It's not original with Rashi, but it comes from an earlier great authority. And that was his guess as to what the verse means. And Rabbi Yosef Kara continues and he says, I have no idea what Psira Pim means. But all I know is it certainly doesn't mean a file. So those are his comments to this particular Rashi. In any event, what they really, and I guess they did well, they said it's Pim. Well, what does Pim sound like? It sounds like it comes from Peh. So it must be a plural of Peh, just a mem at the end, Yeled Yiladim. So Pim is plural of peh, and peh is a mouth. And what does a mouth have? Teeth. It must be some kind of tool that has teeth. A file would be just perfect, and so it must be a file. Of course, the plural of peh is always piyot in Tanakh. The forced nature of these medieval interpretations was evident, but nobody had any solution. Today, the meaning of the word Pim is beyond dispute. Archaeologists have discovered numerous stone weights throughout Eretz Yisrael. Well over 30 already have been discovered throughout Eretz Yisrael, and they all weigh approximately 8 grams. These are weights. And on every one of these stones is written pim, one pim. This is one pim. And of course, you paid out, as you know, either in gold or silver on a scale. You had to put stone weight, so you had to pay one pim or two pims or three pims or a chetzi shekel or a whole shekel, as the case may be. And we have shekels as well. So these were pims. A pim was a weight. And what the verse is saying is not only do the Israelites have to go down to the Philistines to get their tools sharpened, but they had to pay a humiliating fee. Vaita psira, and the charge was a pim. Psira from a related word, vayiftsarban. It's what is urgently requested. The charge was a pim for the tools that follow. On your handout, if I can borrow one for a second. Oh, good, wonderful. Take a look at passage 2. You have a pim in front of you. And any of you that can read ancient biblical Hebrew, it is peyud mem, will soon prove to you that you have no problem reading that Hebrew. But meanwhile, it's... Oh, okay, thank you. In other words, through the efforts of archaeology, it seems to me at least, a verse whose plain sense has not been properly understood for perhaps 2,000 years is understood once again. So much for the time we have for the first level. We move to the second level of archaeological discovery, that is, discoveries that enable us to better understand Jewish thought and biblical law. Whoever wishes to understand Judaism must master Jewish law. The mark of any civilization is reflected in its law codes. Ultimate concerns are always reflected in those law codes. Property rights, respect for persons, freedom of speech, and the like. And the same holds true, of course, for Judaism and Jewish law. Laws, however, cannot be properly understood except within a given context. So all of us who travel and fly will know full well about the severity of security procedures at airports and sometimes at Shea Stadium. And that can only be understood in a specific context, a context of international terrorist activity. Until recently, aspects of biblical law were often misunderstood, precisely because we could not recover the context of those laws. So let's examine some specific laws as they appear in the Torah and were explained in the Talmud, and we shall examine them in situ, that is, in their context, in the context of real-life situations to which these laws were originally addressed. We shall lean heavily on modern archaeology and archaeological discovery, which, as will become evident, enables us to view biblical law from a new and welcome perspective. The intent of numerous biblical laws, indeed the very nature of biblical law, has been sharpened and much light has been thrown on them by the discovery in 1902 of the famous law code of Hammurabi. Hammurabi was a king of Babylonia, today Iraq, in the first half of the 18th century BCE. He set up several stone monuments throughout his realm, and engraved upon those monuments in cuneiform script were some 300 traditional Babylonian laws. Don't know if it's going to be possible for you to see this. It's not in your handout, but I'm going to hold it up anyway, just in case you can see it. So this is a large photo of Hammurabi's code, top part of Hammurabi's code. And above it, you can see it's Hammurabi on the left. So if you've never met Hammurabi, you can see what he looks like. And to the right of Hammurabi, sitting on a throne, is the god Shamash. And inscribed in cuneiform script, which is much too small for you to see from afar, but it's a beautiful copy. You're welcome to come up afterwards and take a closer look at it, are the very laws, some of which I'm going to cite. I'm going to ask you to take a look on page 2 of the handout, passage 3. And there are two parts, two different verses are cited. So, of course, you know in Tanakh, Genesis 9:6, the Bible doesn't look kindly on homicide. And already in Genesis 9:6, a universal law is not limited to the Jewish people. Whoever sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed. For God made man in his own image. So this is a Noahite law, the seriousness of homicide. Later in the Torah, and you can see in Deuteronomy 24:16, we have, even though throughout the Torah, we all know the Ten Commandments, Lo Tirtzach, etc., and so forth. So homicide, we're reminded about it often. There are whole sections in the Torah devoted to the fine laws relating to accidental homicide and so on. But Deuteronomy 24:16 reads, parents shall not be put to death for children, nor children be put to death for parents. A person shall be put to death only for his own crime. And this begs an obvious question. Everywhere we read in the Torah, of course, it's only the guilty culprit that is punished. Whoever sheds the blood of man, his blood shall be shed, not somebody else's blood. Why do I need a verse to tell me that parents shall not be put to death for children, children are not put to death for parents? And Chazal addressed this issue with a variety of answers, but whether they actually capture the plain sense or not is another matter. When we look at Hammurabi's code, just as a sample, and there are other law codes, Sumerian law codes, Babylonian and Assyrian laws, which refer to this very same matter, but I'm just reading from Hammurabi's code. You don't have it in front of you. If a man strikes the daughter of a free man and causes her to die, they shall put his daughter to death. Did you hear that carefully? If a man strikes the daughter of a free man and causes her to die, they shall put his daughter, the perpetrator's daughter, to death. Or in another famous law, if a builder builds a house for a man and has not constructed it properly so that the house caves in and causes the death of the owner of the house, the builder shall be put to death. If it causes the death of the owner's son, the builder's son shall be put to death. The contrast here is striking. According to Babylonian law, this is the second millennium BC, individual members of the family become extensions of the head of the household. They are non-persons. They are treated as property. If A loses a son or a daughter at the hands of B, that is, he lost property, B is punished in the same way, and he loses a son or a daughter, an equal amount of property. And what we have here is a notion that's called vicarious punishment. One person commits the crime, and another person suffers the punishment. Biblical law teaches unequivocally, and so far as I know, for the first time in history, that only the culprit can be held accountable for an offense. No human court. All these laws are in the context of human courts. No human court can punish an innocent man or woman or child for the crime committed by another. Moreover, in biblical law, life and property are very carefully kept separate and not confused. The supreme crime in biblical law is homicide. And there can be no monetary compensation for the taking of life at the end of Sefer Bamidbar. It is a life for a life. On the other hand, property is property, and no property offense, such as theft, can ever be a capital crime. In ancient Babylonian law, in contrast, life and property are often confused. Theft very often indeed is punished by death. In ancient Babylonia and in Assyrian law, vicarious punishment was in effect, condoned the murder, and it condoned the murder of innocent children. The biblical laws of homicide, the biblical laws in the Torah in particular, are in fact protests against injustices in ancient Near Eastern law. We would not know that if we didn't discover and study all these law codes. With that, I leave Tanakh and I move to Talmud. And I'm going to ask you to turn to page 3, passages 4 and 5. I'm sorry, page 2, passages 4 and 5. Passage 4, which is a passage from the Babylonian Talmud, teaches us that the Mem and the Samach of the Ten Commandments stood miraculously. All right, that's passage 4. So the letter is Mem, and it must mean the final Mem, which is a perfect square or circle, and the letter Samach, which is a perfect circle. These two letters stood miraculously. In the Jerusalem Talmud, several opinions are given. I'm just interested in on the third and fourth line, Amar Reb Levi, etc. Ayin b'masa nisu. It was the ayin that stood miraculously in the Ten Commandments. Now, in some passages in the Talmud, it focuses on the Torah itself without mentioning the Ten Commandments. Other passages speak of the Ten Commandments. And that allows for a lot of interesting leeway among the Rishonim, among the great Talmudic commentators. But in any event, we have discussions of ancient biblical Hebrew. The Torah certainly was written as an ancient document, and the Ten Commandments isn't. They were an ancient document. They're not a document. They were carved on stone. In both cases, we have a debate between the Babli and Yerushalmi with regard to which letters stood miraculously. We'll have to find out what that means. And in one, according to the Babylonian Talmud, it was the Mem and the Samach. According to the Jerusalem Talmud, a major opinion is that it was an Ayin. Elsewhere in the Babylonian Talmud, the full text appears in Maseches Sanhedrin. For those who want to research it, you don't have it on the handout. Sanhedrin 21b, where three opinions are presented. We don't have the time to analyze all those opinions, but there too we have the very same debate as to which letters stood miraculously, and there are two opinions. One opinion is that it's the Mem and the Samach, and another opinion is that it's basically the Ayin. What it says in Sanhedrin is that the debate was what was the original script that both the Ten Commandments were written in and the Torah was written in. One opinion has it the original script was Ktav Ivri, Paleo-Hebrew, the ancient script that all biblical inscriptions ever discovered in Israel, all written in that script. They're written in Paleo-Hebrew. And just in case you're not familiar with Paleo-Hebrew, so would you turn to page 3, passage 6, which is a list of the alphabet as it developed through history. If you start on the leftmost column, page 3, right, passage 6, you'll see North Semitic languages immediately on the left. It's moving from left to right through history, and starting with early Phoenician, if you can read the small print. And the second column is Hebrew. That's biblical Hebrew. What you're looking, and if you go up and down vertically on the second column, you'll see every letter of the alphabet, starting from Aleph, Bet, and so on in order as it was written in the biblical period. So that's the Paleo-Hebrew script. As you move to your right and you pass through from early Hebrew, the second column, and you get ultimately to Greek and Latin and so on. And when you get to the last columns, take a look at the last column all the way to your right, you'll all recognize the English alphabet, A, B, C, D, E, F. It's all the same alphabet. There's no real difference of any consequence. So if you can't read the Paleo Hebrew, the ancient Hebrew, and of course, it was an opinion in the Talmud that the Torah and the Ten Commandments were written in that script. So just think of the Latin alphabet, A, B, C, D, E. It's very close to it. And just to bring home the message, in case you don't remember, so you're going to help me out a little bit with Hebrew. Before I do this, I'm going to mention the second opinion. So we'll have both opinions in front of us. The second opinion is that the Torah and the Ten Commandments were written exactly in the same script that we use today in every Sefer Torah. In other words, it's written in Ktav Ashuri, the square Hebrew characters that all of us know how to read. Basar Kasher, it used to be on every butcher shop. That's square Hebrew, Ktav Ashuri. So that's the debate. What script was used in the Torah? I'm going to ask you to help me out a little bit. Hebrew letter Chaf is followed by what letter? Lamed, very good. Lamed. Mem is followed by what? Hebrew letter Chaf is the equivalent of English K, Latin K, right? What's K followed by? L. What's L followed by? And what's M followed by? K, L, M, N, Chaf, Lamed, Mem, Nun. It's not an accident. It's the same script, all right? Q is followed by what in the Latin alphabet? An R. An S. This is the best group I ever met. all right. And Q is Kuf. What is Kuf followed by? Reish and Reish and Shin. Taf. Q-R-S-T. Kuf, Reish, Shin, Taf. So we have a sense of the Paleo-Hebrew alphabet. We have a sense of the Ktav Ashuri, the alphabet that we use to this very day. According to the first view, the view that the Mem and Samach stood miraculously in the Ten Commandments, in the square characters that we use, our Sefer Torah today, all the letters have shapes, they have arms and legs, as the case may be, horizontal and vertical, different parts of the letters, except for two letters that are absolutely a perfect circle or enclosed entirely. What are the two letters? Final Mem. And Samach. Samach is a perfect circle. In the Paleo-Hebrew script, Mem and Samach are not perfect circles. You can look on your second column that you have in front of you. Mem and Samach have arms and legs, so they remain attached, as it were, even if the letters are carved out in a certain way, which I'll describe in a minute. In light of archaeological discovery, that is, that we know exactly what the old Paleo-Hebrew script looked like, and we know exactly, of course, what the square characters look like, the plain sense of the Talmudic passages and debate is very easily understood. The point of departure for the rabbinic discussions is the fact that scripture tells us, this is in Sefer Shmot, Parshat Ki Tisa, Luchot Ktuvim Mishnei Evrehem, Mizeh u'mizeh hem ktuvim. And the rabbis understood that to mean that the Ten Commandments were carved on the stone of the Luchot. And the Ten Commandments are actually a kind of stencil. The letters were made of space. They were carved out through and through from one side of the, from the front side to the back side, as it were, of the stone. And the letters were chiseled out, and it was the periphery of the letters that you read. In other words, they were a stencil, and because of that stencil, you could read the various letters and read the Ten Commandments as they were inscribed on the stone. Well, if you have a perfect circle, a samech or a mem, if the script is square Hebrew, it would be the samach and mem, you would carve out that circle. Let's say take a samach. You would carve out an O, a zero, right? What would define the letter in the Ten Commandments would be empty space, right? You would see O in empty space. You have the peripheries made of stone, and that little piece that remains defines it for you. If try to look at this O. Everybody can see it's an O or a donut, whatever this picture happens to be. The reason you can see it is because it's surrounded by a yellow background, so it's very easy to see the dark against the yellow. And in the center, there's more yellow background. And because of that, you can see the circle that's an O, or we'll call it a samach for our purposes. But if you don't have that dark donut, what you have is just empty space. When you carve out the space, that little yellow piece in the middle that defines the letter disappears. It's going to fall away, unless there's a miracle. And so the rabbi said the mem and the samach of the Ten Commandments stood miraculously in this particular script, if that works very nicely, if the script is Ktav Ashuri. But the Yerushalmi said that the Torah and the Ten Commandments were given in Paleo-Hebrew. Go look on your second column in Paleo-Hebrew to see which letter is a circle in Paleo-Hebrew. And even without looking at the column, you should all know, because we already discussed that the Latin alphabet is very close to Paleo-Hebrew. In the Latin alphabet, you have OP. What is that equivalent to, OP? Ayin is a circle. Ayin is a perfect O. Ayin means the I was drawn as a circle. Ayin, pay, OP. Only one letter has no legs, nothing sticking out. The delta, the D, has a little piece sticking out. Only the Ayin Shebeluchot is an absolutely perfect circle. And so if it was carved out in the old script, that little piece would fall away. You couldn't, all you'd see is a hole. You wouldn't see a zero, you'd see a hole. Okay, H-O-L-E. It's clear as daylight what they were talking about. And what's more interesting, but we don't have the time to investigate it now, is a long list of Rishonim, the Rambam, the Ramban, the Ritva, the David ibn Zimra, the Radbaz in the 16th century, the early Achronim. Every one of them said when they learned this passage, they made search. They found ancient Israelite coins. What they really found were coins from Second Temple times. We actually know which coin they found in the year 67. All ancient Israelite coins, even in Second Temple times, were inscribed only in Paleo-Hebrew script. So they were able to look at the coins. They read the Paleo-Hebrew script, and they said, no problem, we understand the Bavli, and we understand the Yerushalmi. Here's a case where there's a view. Do you mean the view in the Bavli that it's Ktav Ashuri? Everybody could read Ktav Ashuri. There's no problem. Okay. We could turn to passage 4, page 4, passage 7, page 4, passage 7. By the way, here's a Bar Kokhba coin. So now we're in the second century of the Common Era, a Bar Kokhba coin. And you can see the inscription in Paleo-Hebrew in the middle of the page, of course, in square letters right to the right of it. But it says, the top line says Shimon. So what's the third letter from the right in the name Shimon? Ayin, and you see a perfect circle, okay? So there's Shimon Nasi Yisrael on that coin. But I want to tell you how important archaeology really is for us. Shimon Bar Kokhba, in the year 132 of the Common Era, led the second Jewish revolt against Rome. Very little is known about him. And very little was known about him until fairly recently. Even his name was uncertain. In the Talmud, he is always referred to as Ben Koziva. Chaf, Vav, Zayin, Yud, Bet, Aleph. Ben Koziva. Which very clearly is a pejorative term. It's describing him as the deceiver. The one who failed, if you like. The false Messiah. The church fathers always refer to him as Bar Kokhba, the son of a star. So no one was sure exactly what his name was. His first name was known mostly through archaeological discovery. Bar Kokhba coins were discovered very early on. travelers to Palestine and Eretz Israel through the centuries, discovered those coins, read them, and so on. So they knew it said Shimon on it, and they assumed that Shimon, Nasi Israel, though we couldn't be sure, but they assumed that was, in fact, referring to Bar Kokhba. In 1951, among the many other discoveries in the Judean desert, in Wadi Murabat, the first of a series of remarkable archaeological discoveries took place. Military documents were discovered carrying messages from Bar Kokhba, the commander-in-chief, to Jewish officials. A typical letter, and you have it now on the page in front of you, though I must say it's very difficult for you to see it, but at least you can see the English translation. Page 4, passage 8, is one of the Bar Kokhba letters. It's quite an incredible letter. And many of these letters are signed by Bar Kokhba, and we now know that his name was Kosiba, Chaf Vav Samach Yud Beis Aleph, Shimon ben Kosiba. His enemies called him Kosiba, and his admirers called him Bar Kokhba. But his name was Kosiba. And look at that letter. Look at least the English translation. Here he is, the commander-in-chief, sending a note to somebody, obviously before the holiday of Sukkot. And if look at lines 3. This is written in Aramaic. Make sure that you get lulavin, etrogin, line 4, hadasim, and Aravin for our soldiers. So here's the Israeli army in the second century, in a quite amazing letter that's preserved, that the commander-in-chief took the trouble to make sure that his soldiers had what they needed in terms of celebrating a holiday properly. And I like to apply to this famous letter the famous saying, there are no atheists in foxholes. Okay. We'll look at one final passage. I'm going to ask you to turn to page 5. Oh. Okay, I could. I'll mention page 5 very quickly in passing. There's a passage. It's a rabbinic passage in the original Hebrew and translated into English, so you could all follow, which basically defines what are the passages from the Torah that need to be inserted into the tefillin. For those of you who know, the little tefillin or black boxes that are worn on the head and the arm have the exact same material, the same parshiot, both in the head tefillin and the arm tefillin. They're just arranged differently in how they are written for either the arm or the head, as the case may be. But here's a passage that is unique in rabbinic literature. It has no parallel anywhere, not in the Babylonian Talmud, not in the Jerusalem Talmud, not in the Tosefta, an absolutely unique passage. Read through it quickly, either in Hebrew or English, it doesn't matter, or you can look at the words that I underline. And it lists the famous passages. There are two from the book of Exodus, two from the book of Deuteronomy, that must be included in every pair of tefillin, the Arba Parshiot. But there's a whole discussion here about why not include the Ten Commandments in the tefillin? Why not include the Ten Commandments in the tefillin? Nowhere. In the entire rabbinic literature, is there an opinion of any rabbi, any Tano Amora, that tefillin should be included? Yet here there's a whole long discussion, and finally, back and forth, they bring all kinds of proofs to make sure that tefillin are not the Aseret HaDibrot, Ten Commandments, are not included in tefillin. I didn't bring the book with me, so you're going to have to believe me. But in the Dead Sea Scrolls, they found many tefillin, many, many tefillin. Tefillin Shel Yad and Tefillin Shel Rosh. And among the Dead Sea Scrolls, in many of these, they are not 4 parashiyot, they are 5 parashiyot. And the 5th parasha is the Ten Commandments. When the rabbis are writing in the Sifrei on Deuteronomy, which is a very early Tannaitic work, that you may not include the Ten Commandments in the Tefillin, they know very well there's a group of Jewish heretics, Jewish sectarians, who that's exactly what they do. And therefore, we have to make it clear that we don't agree with what they're doing. We would never know that if not for the archaeological discovery. So let's go now just for one final passage, if I have the time. We are on page 6. This probably will be the most difficult passage we're looking at, so we have to concentrate a little bit. Do I have 5 minutes? I don't know if I have the... Okay. We'll try. So this is a Mishnah in Menachot. It's in Yana de Yoma. We're in the Sfira season now. As you all know, there was a special Omer offering, Omer festival, if you like, that for Rabbinic Judaism always took place on the, began the evening following the first day of Passover and moving into this, what's called 15 Nisan. The first day of Passover is always 15 Nisan. So this was celebrated on the evening following the 15th, so the eve of the 16th and into the 16th day of Nisan. And the, it was a barley grain offering. The first barley, fresh barley was cut. Certain amount was gathered together, a very fixed amount, brought to the temple and offered as part of a bunch of sacrificial offering. And then we count Sfira from that day. And the Mishnah Menachot is a wonderful Mishnah, very detailed. We'll look at it in English. How did they implement the reaping of the Omer? Court-appointed agents went out on the eve of the festival, tied. So Erev Pesach. A committee went out from the temple, and they bound the standing grain so it would be easy to reap them with one cut of a scythe, and tied the standing stalks of grain into bundles so that they could easily be reaped. All the neighboring towns assembled there so that the reaping could be done with great ostentation. And there's a whole public ceremony that takes place, almost unheard of in Jewish literature. When darkness fell, the reaper called out to them, "Has the sun set?" Remember, this is the first day of Pesach. First day is ending, and the sun is setting, and you can't cut the grain until the first day is over. So has the sun set? Yes. Has the sun set? Yes. Shall I reap with this sickle? He holds up a sickle. They answer yes. A big crowd, he's asking the crowd, and the crowd is prompted. They know what they're supposed to answer. Okay, they three times, as we will see, every question was asked. Shall the cut stalks of grain be placed in this basket? They reply, yes. Shall the cut grains in this basket? They hold up a basket. Yes, that's the basket. You should cut the grain and make sure you put the grain into that basket. Then it says, when the reaping of the Omer falls on the Sabbath, meaning if first day of Passover fell on a Friday, right? So now, first day of Passover, the 15th, ends with sunset. So now what's when the cutting of the Omer takes place, what day is it? It's Shabbos. So now we have a real problem. Are you allowed to cut the Omer on the Shabbos, right? Well, of course, we say you can. So the Mishnah goes, so on the Sabbath day, they call out three times, on this Sabbath day? Yes, everybody says yes, on this Sabbath day. Shall I reap? It's one of the Lametes Malachos. Shall I reap the grain on the Sabbath? Yep, you absolutely do it on the Sabbath. And then the Mishnah, why such an ostentatious ceremony? Because of the Bethusians. So here we have a sectarian group of Jews mentioned by name, the Bethusians, who claim that the reaping of the Omer does not take place on the evening following the first day of the Passover festival. Look at the Hebrew words, Shehayu Omrim, Ein Ksirata Omer B'motzei Yom Tov. Which means, they say you never cut the grain on the evening following the first day of Pesach. Motzei Yom Tov. And that's what it means. So, and that applied to whether the... It's the first day was Shabbat, for example. The first day was Shabbat, so they would also say, you can't, it's not going to work for us because... You can never cut the grain on the evening that follows the first day of Pesach. Very strange. And it bothers all the commentators, or it bothered many commentators, let's put it that way. Why? Why not? So we have a group that's a heretical group. They're Bethusians. We actually know elsewhere in the Talmud, it tells us what their position was. Their position was... The whole Omer offering is based on a series of verses in Leviticus 23, Parshas Emor. They just read it. The holiday list of the festivals. And the Hebrew reads, Mimocharat HaShabbat. And the Bethusians held that Mimocharat HaShabbat, you start counting Mimocharat HaShabbat on the morrow of the Sabbath, the day after Shabbat, they said Shabbat means Saturday. Shabbat Bereshit. It's plain sense of the words, Mocharat HaShabbat, on the morrow of the Sabbath. The rabbis say it means on the morrow of the first day of Passover, which the rabbis also consider Shabbat, since no melacha is permitted on the first day of Passover. But Bethusian said, it always has to be on a Sunday after a Saturday. Right? Simple as that. It has to be on a Sunday after a Saturday. And the problem with what I just read to you from the Mishnah is, if that's the case, it has to be on a Sunday after Saturday. So if the first day of Pesach is Saturday, which it very often is, the first day of Shabbat, they should have been delighted. Why can't it be on the Sunday after the first day of Pesach? If the first day is Shabbat, so it's going to work out great for us. We have a Saturday and Motzei Shabbat. It's not even a Friday and a Shabbat. It's Motzei Shabbat. We cut the grain. We're very happy. We, the Rabbinites, and they, the Bethusians, should have been delighted that the first day is Saturday, and it's going to work out for them also. If the first day of Pesach is Saturday, the next day is Sunday. It is a Mimocharat HaShabbat by their definition as well. The Shalom al Yisrael. All the Jews should have been very happy and celebrating together. But the Mishnah says, I'm reading it to you again. Look at the last line. Ein tzirat ha'omer b'motzei yom tov. There is never a cutting of the grain after the first day of Passover. I hope you follow the problem. The solution is on the next page. And with that, I'm done. Well, at least, and this is, again, is an archaeological discovery that suggests a solution. I think we shouldn't say more than that. Here's one of the Dead Sea Scrolls. You all know, I'm not going to go into any detail. The greatest archaeological discovery of modern times for Jews, without question, is the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. We have copies of a huge library, all dating from about 300 BC to about 70 AD. And it includes copies of every book of Tanakh, except Megillat Esther, and so on and so forth. So for the first time, we have copies of the Hebrew copies of books of the Bible that are over 2,000 years old. It's quite amazing. Anyway, one of the Dead Sea Scrolls is a Tehillim, and at the end of Tehillim, there's a wonderful passage. Every word here deserves a one-hour lecture. So you're lucky I'm not going to say anything about it. But look at the, we'll save time by reading the English, because we all can follow the English. So this is at the end of a book of Psalms. And a little extra piece about who King David was. And David, the son of Jesse, was wise and light like a light of the sun, etc., and so forth. And the Lord gave him discerning and enlightened spirit, and he wrote 3,600 psalms. Consider yourself lucky you only have 150 today. But he wrote 3,600 psalms. And songs to sing before the altar over the whole burnt perpetual offering every day. So there's Korban Tamid that's brought every day for all the days of the year, 364. And for the offering of the Shabbat, there's a Korban, we bring Musaf on Shabbat. So there are 52 songs for the 52 weeks, for the 52 Shabbats. And then more offerings for the new moons, for the Rosh Hashanah, for the Day of Atonement, 30 songs, and all the holidays and so on. Altogether, it turns out there were 446 psalms, and then songs for making music over the stricken, another four psalms, and the total was 4,050. All these he composed through prophecy. Notice that they don't say it was Ruach HaKodesh, they say it's Nivua. David wrote B'Nivua, and it was given to him before the Most High. All I'm interested in now is in this incredible line that says that they brought a Korban Tamid. It's line, looks like line 5, I'm not sure, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Petrol offering every day for all days of the year, 364. They have 364 days in their calendar. How many days in the Jewish year? Usually 354. 364. Now, there's something magical about 364 and 52 Shabbosos. We don't always have 52 Shabbosos. It depends. But they have exactly 52 weeks, and they have exactly 364 days in a year. 364 is divisible by 7. Try it. 354 is not divisible by 7. That's why in the Jewish calendar, our holidays keep falling on different days of the week. Because every year when the Jewish calendar ends, it ends on a different day than the previous year. We have 354 days in a typical year. But in the Dead Sea calendar, and there it says specifically 364 days. Well, if it's divisible by 7, That means every year, the new year, whatever day new year is, it doesn't matter if it's Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, it's always going to be on that day every year. It never changes. Every festival falls on the same day of the week it fell on the previous year. Never changes. So they have 364 days. It's wonderful. And the truth is, we have their calendar. And I'm going to save a lot of time, and I'm going to give away their calendar to you. So their calendar is a solar calendar. It's a 364-day calendar. And they say, very interestingly, that the sun and moon were created on what day? Who remembers? Which day? Fourth day. Okay, it's Wednesday. So if the sun and moon were created on Wednesday, we don't have a calendar until Wednesday. We can only have a calendar from Wednesday on. So their new year is Wednesday. Rosh Hashanah always falls. One Tishrei is always on a Wednesday. And it turns out that the first day of Pesach, 15th day of Nisan in their calendar, always falls on a Wednesday. And biblically, Pesach is 7 days. It ends the next Tuesday. So it begins on, we'll call it 1:15, Nisan, the 15th day on Wednesday. It ends on 1:21, Tuesday. And they say, Mimocharat HaShabbat means it has to be a Sunday after a Saturday, but it's the Shabbat after Pesach. Pesach ends on the 21st on a Tuesday. 1:25 is always a Shabbos. It's Saturday, and that's the Shabbat they counted from. And the Sunday is Mimorchat Shabbat. That's when they brought the Korban HaOmer. They then counted exactly 50 days, and it comes out 3:15. It comes out that Shavuot for them always fell on a Sunday, also on, just because it's just like Morachat Shabbat is Sunday, so 50th day, 49 days later, is automatically going to be on a Sunday, and Shavuot is always on a Sunday. I don't know, we don't know to this day who the Dead Sea sect is. 100% we don't know. We endless guesses, Essenes, Bethusians, Sadducees, but it's quite amazing that here we have a calendar of an ancient Jewish sect in the time of the rabbis, where it comes out that Mimorachat Mocharat HaShabbat always means the Shabbat after Pesach, and therefore it can never be. It can never take place after the first day of Pesach, even if the first day of Pesach is Shabbat, because for them, Mocharat HaShabbat is always a week after Pesach. Anyway, I hope I persuaded you that it is important to study archaeology. Be well.